Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Since charter school pilot projects funded in the state's operating budget in the late 1990s, charter schools have spread across the state with varying levels of success in both management and educational achievement. Some 300 schools are educating about, well, almost 90,000 students now in Ohio. And the relationships between the boards that are supposed to decide the direction of the schools and the companies hired to manage them have been strained in some cases, and in one case strained to the point of litigation. Coming up later, we'll hear more about the lawsuit filed last spring against White Hat Management, the charter school management company founded by Akron businessman David Brennan. He was a major force behind the charter school law in Ohio back in the 90s. We'll also hear from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and Foundation, a think tank and also a nonprofit sponsor of seven charter schools in Ohio. Right now, we welcome Pete Van Leer. He's a senior researcher for the nonpartisan nonprofit Policy Matters Ohio in Cleveland. Welcome to the show, Pete.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You released a report last month that says some Ohio charter management companies fall short of national governance standards. Who sets those standards and what are they?
Well, these standards that we use, the criteria we used, were published in a commentary by the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, and authorizers are what they call sponsors in Ohio. And he basically laid out these criteria and recommended that they be put into law and used by sponsors to really govern, to set up the relationships between the management organizations and the schools. And there's a lot of things like, you know, charter board should have independent attorneys and accountants and auditors. There shouldn't be any poison pills in the contracts that bind the company, the schools to the companies, makes it hard for the schools to not renew a contract, for instance. You know, that the charter board should control all school revenues, those kinds of things. So we decided to look at how schools in Ohio stack up to those criteria.
Sponsors, governing boards, what are their equivalents in the public school system, just for the folks out there that maybe aren't familiar with the community / charter school lexicon?
Well, it's a lot different. I mean, the public school district, you know, you've got districts that oversee a number of schools. So in a sense, you could think, I mean, in Ohio, each charter school is really its own school district. It's supposed to provide all those services. In some ways, the management companies have taken on the role of a school district or a central office in providing services to however many schools they have, maybe 10 or 12 schools. In the case of White Hat, they've got close to 30, I believe. The sponsors, or as they're called sometimes, authorizers, are supposed to sort of authorize the startup of a school, say, yes, you're all set, you've met the requirements, and then also provide technical assistance to the schools, as in some ways as a district might do to a school, although it's not a direct parallel, and also to provide oversight to make sure that the schools are performing well academically, financially, that they're really running a tight ship and doing what they need to do.
Sometimes when I think of sponsors, I think of that kind of guiding light organization, the one that sort of sets the theme for the school, sets the, you know, the ultimate goals for them, because obviously charter schools are supposed to be different than public schools.
Yeah. I'm not sure the sponsors, most sponsors have that role in Ohio. It seems to be more of a, from what I've seen, a relatively hands-off role. I mean, depending on the school, I suppose. I mean, if you look at what's happening, I think they tend to buy the services that they're supposed to provide to some degree, but they don't necessarily set the standards or the, you know, that what you're saying, that sort of guidance. It's really more that's coming from either from the board or from the management companies that run the schools.
So what has the relationship, what has troubled you about the relationship between management companies and the school boards in Ohio?
Well, what we found, based on our review of a bunch of documents, we looked at management contracts and various other, finding interconnections between companies and management organizations, is that they've really kind of subverted the established norms for governance. And I'm not just talking about school governance. I mean, usually if you have a board, a nonprofit board, that should be the policy-setting organization. And we found that that's really not the case when there are management companies involved. And when I say management companies, I'm talking about the ones that really are comprehensive companies providing comprehensive services. In a lot of cases, they get 90, 95, even more percent of the state revenue that's flowing, of all revenue flowing to the school. It often goes right into company bank account. So they're really, in many cases, calling the shot. The shots about how the school is run. And the board, it seems to be delegated often to sort of a secondary role.
You know, when you talk up, when you compare the management companies to, say, you know, an administrative arm of a school district, it often seems like they're calling the shots too in a regular public school district. But ultimately, their bosses truly are, by law, the school board.
Right.
That's not the case in Ohio, necessarily.
Well, I mean, yeah, the school board is the legally responsible and accountable. The Ohio law says that the school boards are in charge. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, not every school in Ohio,
right,
every charter school in Ohio is working with a management company that provides comprehensive services. By my count, it's somewhat more than half have signed contracts, these comprehensive service contracts. It's a relationship that the school board is supposed to be really calling the shots and has ultimate responsibility, really, by law. But it seems, you know, from what we've seen, that in many cases the management companies really are, you know, in many cases they are deciding where to set the school and then recruiting board members. They incorporate, they have a lawyer incorporate the school, the nonprofit, and then they find board members to sit on the board of that school.
Okay, so now when I think of the board members and who might be on a board of a charter school, I think of parents, maybe local businesses or local educators, or who's supposed to be on the boards?
Well, I think that's left to the people. You know, I think in some ways the ideal is that a community comes together and people in the community, activists, educators, parents, whoever it might be, and they come together, form a board, and get to start a school and figure out how to make that work. What often happens, I mean, that does happen. There are examples I know here in Cleveland, and I'm sure in Columbus as well, of some independent schools that are really doing some good work and providing, you know, what charter schools are supposed to be, sort of an alternative and a model for innovation that other schools, public, you know, district schools can learn from. But as I said before, it often seems that the companies are coming in often from out of state and deciding where they want to set up a school and like I said, recruiting the board from the community in many cases, but not always. I mean, there are examples of people from Columbus serving on a school board in Cincinnati.
Right.
And we even found an example of people from Colorado serving on a board in Ohio. So there are some very real examples of where it's not really who you'd expect it to be, you know, the local people who have a stake in the community.
My guest is Peter Van Leer. He is a senior researcher for the nonpartisan nonprofit Policy Matters Ohio. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about charter schools. Policy Matters put out a report in September. That's what we're talking about right now. That's critical of some relationships between management charter school management companies and the boards that are supposed to be governing the charter schools in Ohio. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. Let's get to the revenue issue. You mentioned that some charter school management companies control upwards of, you know, in the 90 percentiles of the revenue that flows to the school or is supposed to flow to the school. In a school, and again, I want to compare to school districts just to give people some kind of frame of reference. In a school district, what's the difference between that? Doesn't the administration control the money too?
Sure, yeah. The district generally controls the money.
They spend it.
Yeah, they spend it, and they make decisions as how it's run. One of the big differences that we're talking about a school district that is really accountable to a school board, which with a legal authority in all cases in Ohio. And in most cases, Cleveland being one exception, those school boards are democratically elected. And whatever you may think about that, it's part of the democratic process, small d democratic process of, you know, electing your representatives on the school board. And they are overseeing the school district and the monies. What happens in these cases is these are not, whether they're for-profit or non-profit, these are private organizations, private companies. And so there's a measure of transparency that's lost. When the funds flow so directly to a company, and the contracts often read, you know, 95% or 98% of your money will flow into our bank account, and we will disperse it from there. So I think that's a loss of control and blurring the lines of governance, and it's also a transparency issue, because these private organizations, especially in the case of nonprofits, just there's really not a this same kind of transparency you have when you work with a school district.
So what's the difference? If I do a public records request for my local school district to see how they spent money on books, mm-hmm. I can get that. I can find out what they spent mm-hmm. on what
right.
books and what kind of bid process went into it, if there was a bid process was required, mm-hmm. or even if not. Can we see those same kind of records with a charter management company?
My experience is that you can get a certain amount of that and based on what the school has spent, but a lot of the money is wrapped up in sort of general categories like paid services or, you know, purchased services, that it's really hard. You can't really get the details on how it's spent because it's the private company that's doing the spending.
And when a charter school purchases capital, you know, makes capital purchases like a building,
mm-hmm.
or when they buy desks
mm-hmm.
and chalkboards, hardy har har, as if.
Mm-hmm.
Who and there's a management company involved. One of the ones that does it, that's what they do, is manage charter schools. Who owns the property?
Well, that really depends on the situation. And what I've looked at, particularly when I did a report earlier this year on Imagine Schools, they often were the owners, or they had been the owners. They have a subsidiary, a wholly owned subsidiary of their company that does is essentially a landlord. They do all the land purchasing, and they often spin it off to a real estate investment trust. So it's, again, different. They're creating different layers of where it's hard to really find out what's being paid to whom. And in that case, imagine, so the company is essentially paying itself for rent, and there are some pretty high rents there. But in other cases, often it's the management company or a subsidiary or a third party that owns the land, and it's often the management company might lease it and then rent it, sublease it to the school.
And
that's a common thing.
And again, the whole point of that is they can jack up the rent one way or the other.
Well, it's hard to say what, you know, because it's hard to find out what they're paying for rent as
okay.
a private entity. It's really hard to say whether they jack it up or not. And in some cases, like Imagine's Groveport School in Columbus area in Groveport, they were charging last year $1.4 million for two school buildings, which by any standards is a pretty high rate, and it hamstrings the school in terms of spending. That particular school also had the lowest average teacher salaries of any, just about any charter school in the state. So you can see where the priorities are.
We're going to get to this in more detail in the next segment when we talk about the litigation. But you're troubled by a change in Ohio law. I think it was in 2006, right before Governor Taft left office, that mm-hmm. sort of, in your opinion, upset the balance.
Well,
what was
that
change?
That was certainly, and that was actually highlighted by this national authorizer, this national advocate, and he sort of singled out Ohio for that law that really allows, in certain cases, allows a management company to appeal to the Ohio Department of Education or a sponsor to dismiss a board if a board's trying to not renew a contract or terminate a contract. And they can be granted the power to dismiss the board and appoint a new board. So that's a particularly bad, you know, horrible example of how things aren't supposed to work. But we found that even without that law, a lot of this stuff is happening without having to rely on that law. But it's sort of emblematic of the issue, of the pattern of this upending of normal governance that really should be resting with the boards.
We have to take a break right now, Pete, but I do have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you. I was wondering if you could hang on
sure.
for the next segment. Okay, we're talking about charter schools. My guest has been Pete Van Leer. He's with Policy Matters Ohio. He's a senior researcher there, and they released a report in September about problems they see with charter schools and some of the management companies that help run them. We'll be right back. If you have any questions, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. Join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for On Point, Innovation and Economic Rebound. On Point talks with cutting-edge entrepreneurs about what may spark the American comeback. That discussion at 1 this afternoon right here on WOSU.
Support for WOSU comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, featuring the U.S. premiere of the latest work by Belgian company Les Ballets C'est de la Baie, Out of Context for Pina, Friday, October 8th in Ohio State's Thurber Theater. Details at wexarts.org.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:21 this morning. A few clouds, but otherwise mostly sunny skies this afternoon and a nice day with a high of 75. Clear skies tonight, a low of 42, sunshine for Friday, and a high of 78. Looking ahead to Saturday, sunshine and a high of 80 degrees. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about charter schools in Ohio. They've been around since the late 90s. They were first included as pilot projects in the state operating budget. It was when George Voinovich was governor. He signed it into law. And since then, it's spread to some 300 schools in Ohio now, are educating almost 90,000 students. In Ohio, the money comes from the state. Hundreds of millions of dollars over the year have gone to charter schools, just as it would have gone to the public schools that would have served the kids if they went to the public school. My guest right now is Pete Van Leer of Policy Matters Ohio. In a few minutes, we'll get to the litigation afoot. Lawsuit filed last spring. We'll get to that and talk to a couple of folks about that. Pete, a couple issues. I wondered, what is the role of the Ohio Department of Education, or what's it supposed to be?
Well, they've essentially delegated. ODE has started off as a sponsor, and then by the law change, and they got out of the sponsor business. But what their role is essentially oversight of sponsors, and at some level, also making sure this, you know, they're making sure the sponsors are doing what they're supposed to. They do an evaluation that they're trying to beef it up and make it a little bit stronger. But it's a really relatively weak oversight role, and they don't have a lot of staff to do it. But a lot of the oversight of the actual charters, the individual charters, is left up to the sponsors.
And when it comes to profit, when it comes to the profit management companies, what is there some standard for an acceptable margin of profit?
Well, I don't think we don't have any real sense of what the profit is. I mean, if you talk to some of the people from these companies, they say, "Oh, we're losing money in Ohio." There was a study back in, I think, 96 that looked at David Brennan at White Hat and looked at million, you know, I can't cite it, but it was millions of dollars of profit. So it's really hard to say. I mean, I think each individual will bring to that question his own, you know, perspective. I personally have a hard time seeing where profit should play a role in education. It's not like making, you know, widgets or whatever it might be. It's a really different endeavor, and it's harder to talk about profit in that context, I think.
You know, there have been criticisms of Policy Matters Ohio and its work in this regard. Some people say you're a union front organization, that you're just carrying water for the unions, that don't like charter schools because they don't require union teachers, and others say that you want to end the charter school system in Ohio altogether.
Well, we actually get most of our money from foundations, 80-85% of our money from foundations. We do have we do believe people have a right to form a union if they want. And we think the union movement historically has been very important for building Ohio's middle class, among other things. I am not advocating the getting rid of charters in Ohio. I think they have a role to play. Unfortunately, you know, we're talking, A, about the governance issues and taxpayer money that's going to schools. And in many cases, it's hard to know what's happening with that money, and we're not getting very good results academically. I mean, you look at the most recent study, most schools, I think around 80% of charters are doing about as well or much worse. Most of them are doing much worse than comparable public schools. Only about, I think the number is 17% are doing better than a comparable public school. So we're not really getting what was promised from the charter movement. So what I would advocate for is really focusing on the effective charter schools and looking to see what can be learned from them. Because in the end, what's needed in Ohio is a system of education that works for everybody. And few will say that the current system, and especially in urban districts, particularly in urban districts, is working for everyone. But I think we need to figure out how to make a system work so kids don't fall through the cracks. And with the proliferation of charters, what you have is sort of this breaking up of the system that kids are more likely to fall through the cracks. Families who don't have, aren't making a choice to go to a particularly good school, whether it's a district school or a charter school, they're going to fall through the cracks. They're going to maybe get the glossy brochures and go to an Imagine school or a White Hat school. Because I have a young child. I live in Cleveland, and we get these. We're already getting these. My daughter's not even school age yet. So it's a lot about, you know, who we're trying to serve, and policy matters. We believe we need to reach everybody, not just a few.
Okay. That's Pete Van Leer of Policy Matters Ohio. Joining us now is Kurt Minson. He is a board member of Hope Academy in Cleveland and Akron. It's one of the litigants in the lawsuit against White Hat Management. Welcome to the show, Kurt.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Brian Adams. He's president and CEO of Ohio Community Schools Consulting. He's a fiscal agent to 24 different charter schools in Ohio. Brian, glad you could be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
In the lawsuit, the governing boards of 10 schools claim that protections in Ohio law for charter school managers like White Hat are unconstitutional. What's unconstitutional about it? Would either of you, Brian?
Do you want to take a stab, Mr. Minson?
I guess the main thing, well, constitutional or not, let's talk about commonsensical. In a contract law situation like what we see in Ohio, an operator, a management company like a White Hat or an Imagine, literally is in the position where they can remove their bosses, the governing authority, if that governing authority deems that their performance in the schools has been subpar. The protections for the operator are greater than those for the people who actually employ them as a vendor. Now, we can talk about legislation all we want, mm-hmm, and constitutionality, but doesn't that put common sense on its head, I suppose, is what I'm trying to get at. And since there's a huge profit motive for an operator to do things that increase profit, perhaps at the expense of students, there's a likely opportunity for abuse. We as governing authority folk believe that it should be right-sided so that boards have the power to make good choices, to make decisions based on the best educational outcomes, and not be beholden to a manager who thinks that we want to do it this way in order to drive profit alone with little regard for the educational outcomes.
Sure, Brian.
If I may add, the other part of that being non-constitutional is just the fact that there's no due process for the board if an operator appeals to the sponsor, and then the sponsor basically gets rid of the board and the management company is able to put their slate in. There's no appeal process for the boards to go to, say, the State Department of Ed or anything like that.
Kurt Minson, how did you become a board member at Hope Academy, and when did it begin to become clear to you that there was a problem, in your opinion?
Well, the truth of the matter is that I had a friend who had been involved on these boards for a number of years who approached me. He actually is and still remains a pretty good friend of David Brennan. And as an Akronite, I'm quite familiar with Mr. Brennan and talked to him about these boards before I became a part of it. And if you want to know when I found out there was a problem, that would be my first meeting. To be perfectly honest, it was decently contentious. There was a lot of things going on that I simply did not understand. And one of the things we've talked about is that it probably takes a new board member 9, 10, 12 months to become acclimated to all the internal dynamics. But there was a huge struggle going on because of what we saw in the way that management companies were operating the schools with little or no regard for how the governing authority wanted things to be handled in the schools. And that created a ton of tension.
Could you take me through an example? Say you're at a board meeting, and what might happen? What might arise during a meeting that would create conflict between, Hope Academy board members and the management company?
Well, I'll give you a great example.
Okay.
at one point in time, a couple of the board members were very concerned about the attentiveness of the management company to the writing and the submission of grants. And at the end of the day, after many, many requests for information about our grant standing and what was going on, the management company essentially came out and said, well, the person that was handling wasn't really doing a good job. That person ended up no longer being with the company. And many grants that we'd asked about for, I'm loath to say for years, before an extended period of time that were never addressed, just basically went away with the wind. An opportunity for funding to be brought into a charter school, which, of course, every student is paid at a lower rate than a public school, a conventional public school, meant that those dollars could have been acquired for curriculum, for books, for building improvements, for specials that could have added to the efficacy of educational outcomes in these schools, but they were simply passed over. And those types of things were the types of things that led to arguments in board meetings.
Brian Adams, what are the alternatives to a management company? There's yours. Do you do it kind of on an ad hoc basis? You have contracts with different districts to do specific things?
Yes. Well, my company is primarily, we just do finance. And for the non-management company schools that I work with, what I call the mom and pop, so to speak, where there's a traditional superintendent / principal who's there, and then they have their own, they hire the staffs directly and things like that. I'm a outside resource where I just handle all of their finances and ensure that the everything's paid correctly and we have some appropriate source documentation. So there is that alternative out there where, and as Mr. Van Leer has stated, there's about half the charter schools that are out there are the mom and pops, and then the other half you have are the management companies. And how I became involved with the White Hat schools was the board members wanted more financial information, and so they contracted with me to be their fiscal agent / internal auditor to try and help them get information on how the dollars are being spent and how to, and try and help them direct funding in a way that is most advantageous for children.
So in theory, though, wouldn't a management company already be doing what you're doing?
That's true, but you have an inherent conflict of interest with a management company also working as fiscal officer because they are beholden to the CEO of the management company. They're not beholden to the board. And so, I think the traditional districts pretty much have it right. You have the superintendent and the treasurer opposite one another reporting directly to the board, so you have a check and a balance that the board has to allow them to ensure that what the management company or the superintendent wants to do operationally is also meeting sound financial goals.
So how do the charter schools that employ you, particularly the ones that have the larger management companies running things, how do they pay you?
Well, I'm paid directly from the board. I report to the board. My contract is with the board. In the case of Mr. Minson's schools, there's a 5% carve-out that the board gets to keep for its operations. I'm paid out of that 5%. The other 95% goes to the management company.
Mr. Minson, you also in the lawsuit, you're asking three things. One, to void the contract with White Hat. Another one to prevent White Hat from removing anything from the school. Now, public money paid for, all things being equal, unless there's grant money that I don't know about, but public money paid for the materials and the equipment, right?
That is our expectation, yes.
So now the property now is no longer – who owns the property then?
Well, that is what the lawsuit is trying to decide. We, of course, believe that public dollars spent on operating what is essentially a public school should be in the public domain and that a private company should not have ownership of those things. We believe that that is what this lawsuit is ultimately about, is how these public dollars are being well spent. But we also know that charters themselves serve as a wonderful example for innovative educational practices if run correctly. We simply want to restore balance to the equation. And this is part of that balance.
Some governing boards are fine with White Hat management. What's the difference in those cases, do you think? Are you familiar? Do you know other boards out there that are satisfied with the relationship, Mr. Minson?
I'm sure there are going to be people who are satisfied with the relationship, and I really can't speak for them. All I can say is that, and this is just kind of a funny thing, in one of my favorite movies, a character tells another character that he should not think he's in charge of trying to cure the patients in the mental hospital where this person works. He said, that's my job. But then when the alien says back to him, well, why haven't you cured them yet? I had the same kind of pause when I refer to my relationship and some of the relationships I've seen with White Hat. They want to say that we know everything, we have all the answers, but if I'm on a board of a school that's failing, and I actually was on a board of a school that had to close at the end of last school year, then I don't think that argument no longer applies. But we're not in a position to be able to make a choice. Charters were started to bring choice into the equation for underperforming school districts where parents wanted to be able to educate their kids well. And as a governing authority, not being able to make a choice ourselves is a little bit ironic in my mind.
So charter schools that fail, the board is more at risk of being let go than the management company in those cases.
If I may answer.
Yeah, sure.
There is no incentive or disincentive, I should say, if a school fails academically for a management company not to just start up another operation the next day with another sponsor. So to answer your question, if there's poor academics, there's no repercussions for them saying that they must wait 2-3 years or something along those lines before they're able to open up another school. In theory and in practice, I've seen you can open up the very next year under a new sponsor, under a new name, and move forward.
Okay. We're out of time for this segment. I want to thank my guest, Kurt Minson of Hope Academy, where he is a board member. Thanks a lot, Mr. Minson, for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me.
And also Brian Adams. He's president and CEO of Ohio Community School Consultants. Brian, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. When we return, joining us will be Terry Ryan. He is vice president for policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. It's a think tank and nonprofit sponsor of charter schools in Ohio. We'll take those calls and those emails then. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll have a preview of tonight's second and final debate between the candidates for Ohio's governor's race. And joining us in the studio will be a panel of State House reporters to discuss that. That begins at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820.
Support for the State House News Bureau stories on WOSU comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at ohea.org.
Get the latest information from our station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Just go to wosu.org/email, and there you can sign up for one of our e-newsletters. 58 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Mostly sunny skies today and a high of 75. Clear skies tonight and a low of 42. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how some of those 300 charter schools in Ohio that educate almost 90,000 students now operate with management companies overseeing the operations. Joining me now is Terry Ryan. He is vice president for policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a think tank and nonprofit sponsor of charter schools in Ohio. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Ann. I feel like I'm going to be talking about a family divorce after listening to the previous part of the show.
Well, it is an emotional. Schools are a very emotional topic.
Indeed, they should be. And I would like to note that 8 of the top 10 schools this year in Dayton were charters. 6 of the top 10 schools in Cleveland were charters. So not all charters are bad. There are certainly some that aren't doing the work the way they should. And we're big proponents of holding them accountable and ultimately closing them if they don't deliver results.
Are you only concerned with results, or are you concerned about these conflicts over management?
Well, it raises a moral dilemma because at the end of the day, I think I'm most concerned about results, but I'm also concerned about people doing it in a way that's fair, transparent, and reasonable. But when you look at sort of education in America, you look at education, bring it to Columbus, and you realize that there's a middle school called Champion Middle School that was chronicled in the Columbus Dispatch. And for a decade, only 20, 23, 24% of the kids have been able to get to the proficient level in reading and math. You have to say, is this working? Is this really working for all kids, or do we need to do something about it and come up with some innovative approaches to doing it? That's what charters were about. But they also have to be held accountable for results. They have to be held accountable for how they spend state dollars. And I think we've made real progress in this state in moving in that direction. Is there more work to be done? Absolutely. But we have an automatic school closure law in this state now that closes the most dysfunctional schools and actually has closed some schools. And I think one of your guests actually mentioned that one of the schools he was a board member of is closed.
Right, but the management companies like White Hat Management or Imagine or any of the ones, they can turn around and just open up another school the next day.
Well, it's not that quite that easy.
It's an exaggeration to make a point, I suppose.
We do have certain caps, and to open another school is not as easy as one might think because this notion of quality is starting to permeate the conversation, and people don't want to be associated with failure, and they don't want to be associated with lawsuits. And if you look at White Hat and you look at the numbers, look at the number of state dollars that have gone to White Hat, and you look at the number of kids that are served by White Hat, they're down. That's good.
That is good. Why?
The fact of the matter is that people who are saying these schools aren't working, we're no longer going to send our kids there, and the state dollars aren't going to follow them there. Therefore, they're in effect being closed and seeing a diminishing share of the educational marketplace or opportunity. And other decent schools are emerging, both some innovative district schools that are emerging as a result of this, in Cleveland, for example, or down in Cincinnati. So we're seeing an evolution here. We're seeing this notion of school choice, giving parents an option, evolving. And I do believe we're slowly, way too slowly, moving towards this notion of quality. And I mentioned Dayton and I mentioned Cleveland. Two cities have been at this longer than many in the country, most in the country. So progress is being made. I think it's important that we say that after the previous 40 minutes of what's been going on.
Well, I didn't get the sense that anyone was trashing the concept of charter schools or the success rates of them per se. It seemed to be more discussion about who's in control of the money and what kind of transparency there is about how the money is spent with for-profit management companies.
So we're an authorizer of 7 schools in the state of Ohio, and we authorize 2 in Dayton that are run by a for-profit company called Edison Learning out of New York City. Mm-hmm. Speaking bluntly, one of their schools has been making good academic gains. The others has not. And in terms of how it operates, I can tell you that in that instance that I know, we're the authorizer. We ultimately make decisions about the life and death of those 2 schools. And that's a responsibility we take very seriously. We have contract language that allows us to do that, both with the state and with the 501c3 governing board in Dayton. That board in Dayton is made up of community leaders, a former lawmaker, business people, a woman who leads one of the largest churches in Dayton. None of them take any payment at all. They're doing it as volunteers. They have a contract with Edison Learning to run these 2 schools. We have an independent accountant who actually is there and tracks the money. Do we know how every cent is spent on every pencil? We do not. But what we care about are the schools delivering results. And one of them is, one of them isn't. And that's a quandary for us that we're going to have to deal with. And I encourage people to pay attention to how it's dealt with.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Terry Ryan. He is Vice President for Policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. It is a think tank and a nonprofit sponsor of charter schools in Ohio. 8 charter schools, right?
7.
7, sorry. How should school success be measured when it comes to charter schools?
Well, this is going to drive some people nuts, but I think test scores matter.
What kind of test scores?
I think that in this state we have a fairly sophisticated assessment system in that we have measures of both raw proficiency. Are the kids proficient based on a state standard? And those standards are improving and are hopefully going to get even stronger in the next few years through this thing called Common Core. We also have a thing called value added, and that is, are kids making gains? Are they making a year's worth of gains over an expected period of time? And so we have both achievement and growth metrics that we can look at. These are good for K-8 schools. I feel like we have a pretty good understanding. If you look at a K-8 school over multiple years, 4 or 5 years, you have a pretty good sense of whether or not they're delivering results and they're making gains towards delivering better results. It gets harder when you talk about high schools. There's the fewer sort of indicators there. And it gets really hard when you talk about these dropout recovery schools. These are schools that are geared towards kids that, go to school for a while, drop out, come back. They're the metrics in the state. Really, we don't have any state in the union where the metrics are really good for measuring the success of those schools.
Is it different or more difficult? There aren't as many metrics for high school students because they're taking so many different things. They're not on the same track and lockstep with each other.
Well, so yeah, that's part of it. Okay. So you have in Ohio, you have testing through 3 through 8, and then you're able to do value add in 4th, and that is okay. So the third grader went to the 4th grader. Was there a year's worth of gains? And then you can have that through the 8th grade. You don't have that in high school because the only state test that we have so far is the Ohio graduation test. Now, I think that's going to be phased out and we may move to the ACT or something else. But it's just a one-shot test. Are the kids at a basic level that we think they need to be in order to issue them a high school diploma? It doesn't get into issues of are they making gains so they came in at the 9th grade at an 8th grade level and are leaving at the 12th grade with a 12th grade reading level. We don't have that sophisticated level of metric with state data. Some schools do that with NWEA, computer adaptive testing, and these national tests. This is probably more wonky than you care. But
not for me, but maybe some
okay.
of the listeners.
Sorry.
That's okay. 614-292-8513. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Ann. Love this show. My kids go to charter schools, and we've had great success. I like the fact that I think when I talk to people there, as opposed to when they went to public school, I get the feeling that we have more of a relationship where they need me as much as I need them, because I got good kids and they get good grades. The other thing is because they're usually smaller schools, I know all their teachers. Their teachers all know me. Everyone, And there's more of an intimacy, but none of that will work if I was in a situation where I couldn't be attentive to my kids, then that wouldn't be effective. And so I think the numbers that the charter schools are turning out now with the 17% success rate is over the public schools, I think just is indicative of what I think is just, it's not that complicated an issue. Successful schools has to have lots of money, and countries that have successful education systems spend a lot of money on their kids. People in this country that have successful kids spend a lot of money on their kids. It's with the schools are flatly underfunded, and it doesn't matter if they're public or private or charter or whatever.
And when you talk about spending money, you're not just talking strictly about what the school spends, but the kids also come from households where their parents pay attention to them. Their parents spend money on them. Their parents are engaged.
But, those kids that go to private schools and that go on to go to Harvard and Yale, they went to schools throughout their lives, and the schools, they were not spending $6,000 a year on their child's education. They were spending $20,000 a year on their child's education. So, people say, well, throwing money at the problem won't solve it, but underfunding it will definitely cripple it. And that's what we've been doing for the last 50 years in this country, is seeing just how little we can invest in our children.
So
it's a backward idea.
Okay.
And the rest of the world is surpassing us as a result.
the literacy rates aren't what they might be in a country like the United States.
I think they're improving, but the thing of it is that if we've sort of got this mantra that everything from the government is patently incompetent and that we are taxed enough already, but I think that's a baseless premise. In fact, we're spending less on our kids than any developed country in the world, and you can see across the board. If you're willing to spend a lot of money on your kid will do better.
Okay. Robert, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Ann.
Take care. So, is it just a matter of money, do you think?
No.
Terry Ryan?
It is not. And we've seen steady increases in spending on public education in this state, as we have in the United States, actually. And since 1991, in the first Roth case, we've seen spending increase about 61% using inflation-adjusted dollars per pupil. And we've not seen results improve in any sort of correlation to the spending. And this is a tough one for the charter school crowd, though, and I'm one of them, to say, well, look, we haven't even started to move the needle much either in the whole great collection of things. If you look at the data, the charter school students from all 300-plus schools, and you look at the district school kids from the same types of schools, basically the results have been flat for 5 years. So we've been adding money, certainly at the district level, with new buildings and these sorts of things, and we're not seeing gains. We're not seeing dramatic results. There are pockets of exceptions. They're Cincinnati. God bless them. This year, the first big urban district since 1997 to be rated effective. And so we're seeing it. I think it's not just a matter of money. It's how we allocate teachers. It's how we think about school leadership. It's how we recruit teachers and who we get into the teaching profession. I mean, there are a number of issues here. And it's also about sort of how we regulate education. And this is not good radio, but I have the school law. It's a massive book.
Makes good television, though. We are live on television now.
But, so we've boxed ourselves in a number of ways in terms of handcuffing our ability to really try to do things that have the potential to make profound impacts in education. So we just make small incremental gains.
How much, though, is parent involvement involved? Because with charter schools, it's inherently more parent involvement because somebody took the initiative to put their kid in a charter school, even if they're not paying one dime extra than what they would have if their kid went to a public.
So it's the classic chicken and the egg argument.
It's true.
I have a friend who runs Citizens Academy up in Cleveland. Everybody would agree, including Pete, that's a great school. And they work really hard to engage their parents. They go out of their way to make sure that the parents understand they have responsibilities when it comes to this school, that they're expected to do certain things as it relates to this school. Other good schools do that as well. There are district schools that are doing the exact same thing.
They are, but district schools can't require parents to do it. Charter schools almost could if they wanted to, couldn't they?
Well, the charter schools have to take the kids that show up at the door.
Okay,
I mean, they do. That's under law. I think one of the great things that charter schools have successfully done in this state and elsewhere, the really good ones, have engaged parents. They've said to parents, we're a partner with you. We need you involved in this. And some, you know, will make absolutely certain that they're communicating with parents all the time. And you'll have parents who will say to you that, look, I love this school because they care and I have a voice. And so does that answer the question?
Yep. Let's take a couple emails and we'll try to get in a couple more calls. This is from Barb. My son went to a charter school, VIA Academy, Vision into Action, back in 2006. He did graduate, has a diploma and everything, but the school is now gone. It was opened again with a different name, Capital City Academy, and now that school has now disappeared, and now it is called Columbus Bilingual Academy. My son is trying to find a job and might want to go to a higher education school someday, and the charter schools cannot find my son's transcript. I hope charter schools these days keep better track of records. That's an interesting point when they open and close like that. What does happen to the credentials of a student who graduates?
I mean, in that instance, it's scandalous, and I feel for that parent. So the schools that have closed, there are a couple ways of looking at it. One is the authorizers have boxes of these records in their office. The Ohio Department of Education, for some of these records, they have access to the records. Some of the records, if they transfer from a charter back to the district, the records should go with them to the district school. But in this instance, I can't speak to that particular case other than it's tragic that child has lost those records.
And what's more is somebody's looking over their records and they're trying to decide whether they hire them, you know, accept them into a school. But they can't go back to that institution and say, this is a high-level, high-functioning institution or a low-functioning school or however that might work. An A from this school means more than an A from that school kind of comparison. They can't do that in those cases.
I would say they could not. You're correct.
Okay. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to ask you about the whole profit motive. Is there an acceptable level of for-profit margin of profit for school, for charter school management companies and charter schools in general?
I don't look at it like is there an acceptable profit for charter schools in general.
Okay.
I look at the fact of the matter is that much of what happens in education is about profit. And the fact of the matter is textbook companies are the classic example, testing companies. Think about the amount of money that we spend, teachers in effect get wages. Those, you know, one could say are profits. The fact of the matter is that a lot of state money is spent on public education. And the notion that you're going to have some for-profit companies that can make money by delivering a higher quality product, I think is better in theory than it has been in practice. I don't think, honestly, that there are many for-profit management companies in the state that have made a lot of money educating kids here. And I would encourage them to actually be more open and transparent with the money so that people can see. You have the one caller saying, well, there's not enough money going into education. And we're saying to the for-profits, well, we're going to give you 70% of the funding that the traditional district schools get. You have to go out and figure out how you're going to open buildings because you don't get any facility dollars, and then make a profit on top of it. And by the way, we're going to hold you accountable for results. We're going to hold you accountable for delivering performance. And that, at the end of the day, must be done. If you're not holding them accountable for performance, then they can kind of steal the money or whatever it is that people think they're doing. And that's why it's so incredibly important to hold them accountable for results.
I can't get to the call, but one caller is asking, he's a former teacher, what's the pay like for teachers there? And in traditional public school districts, teacher pay is a big percentage of the overall budget, right?
It's a big percentage of the overall budget.
And anywhere.
Too,
human,
right?
And
it's
human
like
resources
80,
are always.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but they do pay teachers less. Because
some
they
charters
don't.
Do, some don't. I mean, the fact of the matter is it depends on their model. You've got some of the charters that hire younger teachers, pay them less, no doubt. You have others that go out and rustle up a lot of philanthropic dollars in order to come up with a bonus pool and pay their teachers more. I can give you examples. There are examples here in Columbus or examples in Dayton and Cleveland.
Okay. That's all the time we have. I'm sorry I can't get to those phone calls. I apologize. We'll have to have another program on this, I promise. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Terry Ryan of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, where he is vice president for policy. Thanks again, Terry, for being with us.
Thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.